So if we're going to examine the question, can prisons work, we should begin by returning to the source of that troublesome phrase. And here is the source. It's a speech by Michael Howard as Home Secretary to the Conservative Party conference in 1993. So I'd like you to pretend for a moment that you are the estimable audience at that event and applaud in the right intervals. I'll demonstrate how this works. Mr. Howard says, "Prison works. It ensures that we are protected from murderers, muggers and rapists, and it makes many who are tempted to commit crime think twice." Tumultuous applause. "This may mean that more people will go to prison. I do not flinch from that. We shall no longer judge the success of our system of justice by a fall in the prison population." Now, here Mr. Howard is saying several things which bear on the question of what it means to assert that prison works. And I've emboldened the obvious ones to give you a clue what they are. He says we are protected from murderers, muggers and rapists by prison. And he asserts that prison makes many who are tempted to commit crime think twice. So, in more formal terms, what he was saying, in terms of the ways in which philosophers of punishment and other people who write and think about this kind of topic, he's activating two principles. First of all, the principle of incapacitation. Prison works because it takes people off the street and protects us from their ill doings while they are in prison. And secondly, the principle of deterrence, i.e., prison is a sufficiently aversive penalty that it causes people to hesitate before they commit a crime, and if it works, stops them doing so. Now, if you take those two principles as being what prison does and the ways in which it works, then it's unsurprising that you should not wish to build your policy around a fall in the prison population, as his immediate prison predecessors had been doing, because you think prison achieves at least two good things from the point of view of public safety and crime prevention. It incapacitates and it deters. Now, in the immediately foregoing period, we're talking mainly about England and Wales now, because that's where the expression was coined. It has had various baleful effects on Scotland. We'll come to those in a moment. One of Mr. Howard's predecessors as Home Secretary, Douglas Hurd, had instituted something called the Criminal Justice Act 1991, which was preceded by a white paper that included the argument that, quote, prison is an expensive way of making bad people worse. So two or three years previously, the official policy of the same party had been precisely to drive down the prison population on the grounds that it didn't work, was inefficient, made bad people worse, and was expensive. For what reason did Michael Howard reverse so dramatically that view, and with what effects? And was he right to do so? I think I should say at this point that I'm not alleging that Mr. Howard was just being a cynical politician in saying what he said, although he no doubt basked in the warm applause, as I've just done, that you get when you say this kind of thing. He meant and believed this and was quite sincere. This is a statement of conviction. But as sceptics, you can also see that it's an empirical claim. He was claiming factually that prison operated to achieve certain measurable goals. It protects us and it deters people. So how do we go about ascertaining whether this was true? And also, what were the effects of his so saying? Well, the effects were quite drastic. If I could just show you this, you can't read the print, no doubt, on this graph. This graph was prepared internally by Home Office civil servants, I think, in order to try to stop politicians saying exactly the kind of thing that Mr. Howard did say. Because their concern was that those sorts of utterances from important people on big public platforms themselves had effects on what happened to the prison population. So they note a whole series of policy interventions and the effects that they've had on policy interventions and other events, and the ways in which the prison population is answerable, in the view of those sceptical people, not to whatever was happening in the crime rate, but rather to political events and legislative actions. So, this is the moment of the Criminal Justice Act 1991. Even before the Criminal Justice Act came into effect, the prison population was sharply falling because the working premise of the government of the time was that prison was an expensive way of making bad people worse. In 1993, three important things happen. There's Mr. Howard's speech. Following a few months, four important things happen. Black Wednesday resulted in the withdrawal of the pound from the European exchange rate mechanism and a catastrophic decline in the popularity of the Conservative government. James Bulger was murdered in Bootle by two 10-year-old boys in January of 1993. And within weeks of that event, Tony Blair coined the expression, tough on crime, tough on the causes of crime, which we now know to have been given to him by Gordon Brown, but it became Tony Blair's mantra of the period. So, we have a government undergoing a catastrophic period of decline, from which they never recovered, prior to 1997. We have a country, England and Wales, convulsed by anxiety over a key signal event, the Bulger murder. We have an eager political competitor campaigning on the same ground, and we have Mr. Howard fervently believing that prisons work. So from that moment on, you can see that the violence and rapidity with which the graph of the prison population of England and Wales turned around, the prison population increased year on year, every year, for about the next 10 years, and continued to rise thereafter, but albeit at a slightly reduced rate. So, this is the context in which the prison works claim was made. Although it's an empirical claim, it works. It wasn't subjected to precise empirical testing, at least not in England and Wales, it wasn't. In fact, these same pesky civil servants who drew this graph had earlier supplied Mr. Howard with a set of calculations which suggested that in order to achieve a 1% drop in the crime rate, you would have to have about a 15% increase in the prison population. So they said, effectively, prison could work on grounds of incapacitation and deterrence if you buy into it in a really massive way, and then the kind of return on your massive investment in prison building and prison costs and all of the other kind of associated downsides of imprisonment will produce a marginal change. So, does it help if we think about these problems a bit more in a comparative way? Let's try and situate what has happened in England and Wales and in Scotland in some kind of comparative perspective in order to see whether the claim that prison works on grounds of incapacity and deterrence stands up. So, here we have, you see these all the time if you read these kind of Scottish Government prison statistics, there are all kinds of sources for this sort of information out there. The Council of Europe publish these figures on a regular basis. The variation in ways in which societies make use of imprisonment contemporarily is huge, ranging from the numbers here relate to numbers of people in prison per 100,000 of the population. So in Japan, which is generally the low end of this distribution, there are 58 people per 100,000 of the general population in prison at any given moment. In the United States, there are 743 at the time this graph was made. Interestingly, England and Wales and Scotland almost always appear adjacent in this kind of graph, and in roughly in the middle. Now, does this clarify in any way the prison works claim? But one of the interesting things about it is it really doesn't, because countries that appear next to each other in this kind of graph may be doing radically different things in the ways in which they use prisons. So, in Japan, which looks like a very lenient society on this estimation, sends few people to prison for a long period of time. In other words, it uses imprisonment for certain kinds of very serious crime. When those things happen, you get the book thrown at you and you're in prison for a considerable length of time. Next to them, you generally find the Scandinavian countries, which do look as though they're in a similar position to Japan, but actually do something radically different, which is to say they send quite a few people to prison, including for offences that we often don't, such as motoring offences, but for very short periods of time. So in those cases, the throughput of people into the prison is actually quite quick, but most people only stay there for a short period of time. Indeed, in Norway and in Sweden, the definition of a long sentence, a long-term official definition, the statutory definition of a long-term sentence is one over 18 months, whereas in both England and Wales and Scotland, it's over 4 years. And in some other countries, as we'll see, it's much longer. In southern Europe, for example, Greece, Portugal, what tends to happen is a bit more similar to Japan, in that not very many people go to prison, relatively speaking, but they go there for long periods of time. So you have to understand, in what look like similar behaviours, there are actually quite contrary ways of using this institution, which would work very differently on Mr. Howard's account of what the meaning of prison works actually is. Indeed, England and Wales and Scotland, which always appear next to each other, also behave quite differently. So Scotland has many more shorter sentences than England and Wales does. And England and Wales, on the other hand, passes more long sentences than Scotland does, but doesn't use short prison sentences to anything like the same degree. If either of them were to change their behaviour in one of those particulars, they could reduce their prison population quite distinctly. If Scotland were to stop using prison sentences of under 6 months or under a year, to the extent that it does, the prison population would fall rapidly. Conversely, if in England the average length of a long prison sentence for robbery or of a life sentence were to fall, but in other respects they maintained their behaviour constant, their prison population would fall. So, it's not clear whether even comparing these things internationally on this basis actually helps us very much, except certain countries stand out as kind of beacons of severity, in the sense that there are roughly, in the world at any given moment these days, there are about 10 million people in prison. And a third of those are in the United States, the Russian Federation, or South Africa. And a very great number more are in China, although that tends not to appear on these graphs because the figures perhaps are not considered sufficiently robust. So, there's a preponderance of use of prisons in certain times and places. The reasons why it is used are difficult to compare to one another. That leaves us in a bit of a pickle in trying to work out what it means to say whether prison works and what we want to do about it. We can make ourselves slightly more confused yet, if we wish. Here goes. Just before I move on, what did Mr. Howard not say when he asserted that prison works?
Punish.
He didn't say it was for punishment, exactly. Anything else?
He didn't see how it worked for people inside it.
He certainly didn't. So Mr. Howard made reference to two, if you like, of the four great arguments about what it might mean to say that prison works and why that would structure your policy. He didn't say it exacts proportionate punishment for crime, and that is its justification. He said it worked because it incapacitates and deters. And furthermore, he didn't say it changes people's behaviour by making them in any way better than they had been previously. Which is interesting, I think, because as I'm about to show you in a moment, that has been one of the primary grounds, historically, for the very existence of the prison as an institution rather than other possible modes of punishment. And in a moment when that was no longer being stated as a primary reason for sending people to prison, that it rehabilitated, changed, or otherwise helped them, nevertheless, the prison population rose steeply. So we were living through a moment at which, in a way, one of the great historical pillars for using imprisonment at all, or for the very existence of prisons as institutions historically, had been, in some sense, cut away. We see a significant rise in the prison population in several countries, which seems a paradox that we might need to explore further. So here's what happened to both to prisons and recorded crime in Scotland over roughly the same period from the early 90s onwards. Now, non-sceptical people might say, well, look, the prison population rose from around 5,000 to, in 2006-07, I haven't got a more recent graph than this, somewhat over 7,000, it's gone up by another 1,000 or so since, and crime fell. Does that count as an argument that prison was working during this period? What do you think?
Depends on your definitions.
Well, if your definition is that increases in the prison population produce decreases in crime rates, you might want to claim on this basis. Yep. So the graphs cross at some point, but actually, within that, their shape is not that systematically related. So there have been moments at which both crime and imprisonment rates have been rising. There have been moments in which the prison population has been flat and crime has fallen. There have been moments when they've both fallen, and then there's a moment when they diverge. So it would be stretching a point to claim that there's a kind of systematic pattern in this relationship. But nevertheless, people who do want to argue that prison works love it when these graphs cross. And I'm going to show you how that worked in the United States in a second. But you should also note that we're comparing the two sides of this diagram. The way in which the prison population is calibrated here is in thousands. Recorded crimes are in hundreds of thousands. So you would need a fairly heroic assumption that a 1,000 increase in the prison population had produced a fall of some hundreds of thousands in the recorded crime rate. In other words, that the ratio between, for each marginal increase, each new prisoner, you were producing a fall in recorded crime of well over 100 offences. That might be true, but it might be stretching the claim a bit. So, and here, conversely, is what happened to the prison population in England and Wales in relation to recorded crime during the same period. The prison population rose more steeply than in Scotland, but the crime rate rose and fell, I would argue, relatively independently of that increase over that period of time, and as yet the graphs did not cross. You would need a similar assumption about the effectiveness in prison per prisoner in order to be able to argue that that was, as it were, the primary causal factor in making changes in the crime rate. However, in the United States, people who are disposed to think the prison works on grounds of incapacitation and deterrence tend to argue, because these the graphs cross early on and stayed crossed, that there is evidence that prison worked. But here we're talking about numbers that compute in a very different way. So this is an increase in the prison population from less than a million in 1989 to well over 2 million. So the prison population over this period has increased by well over a million people in a decade. It would be surprising if that had no effect on the crime rate at all, because the whole principle, I mean, incapacitation and deterrence are real things. The basis of this discussion is not to argue that you can never decrease crime by incapacitation or never deter people from crime by the threat of a long prison sentence. The question is, what else can you do, and how effective or efficient are those ways of approaching the problem? And moreover, does that policy have other kinds of knock-on effects which are undesirable and might have other kinds of bearing on the crime rate further down the line? But anyway, many American observers have used this phenomenon, that the prison population rose steadily and steeply for this period of time and the crime rate fell, to justify and vindicate the argument that having many, many people in prison is an indispensable prop to public safety. So let's do a little bit more international comparison and see how well that stands up, which is something that most American commentators don't engage in. So here we have Spain. Okay, the prison population and the crime rate both rose sharply and in an apparently consistent way, which suggests that the prison population is the dependent variable in this relationship. It was pulled up by the crime rate, or something like that, maybe. And here we have the Canadian prison population and crime rate over the same period, in which both fell sharply, which is, apart from the fact that the crime rate then began to rise after 2000, up until that point, it's tracking the decline in the American crime rate almost, you know, very closely during a period when the prison population was also falling. So these relationships, if they exist at all, are local and contingent and specific and culturally and geographically variable, and it's very difficult to generalise from these graphs, which don't even, it seems to me, have the same shape, let alone that a single proposition can be sustained. So, that makes things complicated. Let's try to work out what this prison's work thing is about by taking a more historical perspective. What have people meant since the inception of imprisonment in its modern form by asserting that they worked, and what have they doubted when they said that they didn't work? So where did modern prisons come from? Why are they as they are? And what do we want them to achieve, and for whom? In other words, what would we mean by saying that they were to work or not work? So I'm going to take you back now to the early history of prisons in their modern guise, which is not, funnily enough, all that far. In big historical terms, modern prisons are historically distinctive. There have always been places of confinement, lockups, jails, dungeons, prison ships, ways of holding and confining people for various purposes. But the idea of sending people to prison as the primary instrument of a criminal justice system under sentence only really begins to become a widespread phenomenon round about the end of the 18th and the beginning of the 19th centuries. And many people would argue that it starts here. This is does anybody know where this is? Has anyone been there? The Eastern State Penitentiary. This is Philadelphia. This is the city of Philadelphia as it now is. The Eastern State Penitentiary is a museum. It's a very, very interesting place. It's maintained in the form of what they call a stabilised ruin. So it was used as a prison from the 1820s to the 1970s, and then it was allowed to fall into disrepair and only subsequently opened as a prison. So it's a very, very spooky and evocative place to go round. What they've done is they've restored certain little sections of each corridor so that you can see how it would have looked when it was in kind of full operation, and the rest of it they've left in its ruined state. Anyway, as you can see, it was built on this radial pattern, meaning that it was a very efficient kind of building. A few people could manage it. They could supervise the behaviour of many people who were confined there. And that worked kind of like this. So you have a central point where the staff observe, they look around, they send people down the corridors. The inner boxes on each of these kind of windmill arms of the thing are cells. And the outer ones, which are slightly fainter, are exercise yards. So each cell comes with its own yard. Why is that, do you think?
Isolation.
Yeah, that's right. It's complete isolation. So the principle on which the Eastern Penitentiary was founded was that the only way to save people from themselves and their low, demeaning, corrupting associations with other criminals was to isolate them from one another. And it's not called a penitentiary for no reason. Their isolation was precisely supposed to induce in those captives a spirit of penitence resulting in religious conversion. So you would be alone, isolated from others, but with the opportunity to study the Bible, reflect on your behaviour, and change yourself, and to achieve grace. If you don't believe me, in parenthesis, this was related to a design that was invented by the English philosopher Jeremy Bentham at the end of the 18th century, which he called the panopticon. He hoped to make himself rich by his creation of a new kind of prison which would be maximally efficient and affect people's behaviour in a revolutionary new way. And that is to say, it would be built on a circular design with all the cells facing inwards, and only a very few guards would be able to supervise everyone. This isn't quite a true panopticon, because in Bentham's design, all that would be visible here would be an isolate. So the point being that you never knew whether you were under observation or not at any given moment. So in principle, he argued, one person could supervise, regulate and control the behaviour of a whole great number of people at any one time. And this was, he said, a way of obtaining power of mind over mind, in a quantity hitherto without example. So prisons were supposed to radically change people's behaviour. They were supposed to control them in the most efficient possible manner, without overt violence, without brutalisation, without all of the kind of paraphernalia of torture and degradation of previous eras. So it was supposed to be a civilising but maximally controlling penalty. This is Stateful Prison in Illinois, which is one of the most pure panopticon prisons ever constructed. So remember that. Power of mind over mind is what Bentham thought the prison was going to be about. And the architects of the Eastern Penitentiary didn't think, as Mr. Howard did, that prisons exist only to incapacitate or deter. They thought they were transforming souls. So that in that state of isolation, penitence, and individual sort of inwardness and reflection that was produced by that isolation, what was happening is that souls were being saved and people were finding their way to God. So you can see, I think, that it's a long way What's the strange thing about this is we're talking about the historical transformations of a single institution whose basic shape is fixed from that period of around the 1820s onwards, but which has been used for all kinds of different purposes over the 200 or so years of its modern existence. But that the that kind of high ambition of leading people to a happy life and by a peaceful end to heaven has given way to pragmatic principles of control and not changing behaviour, but by reducing crime by instrumental means of incapacitation and deterrence. So how did that come about, that these high hopes have subsided at the same time as the prison has become globally the dominant form of punishment and is now found in every kind of modern or modernising society of which we know? This is what the Eastern Penitentiary looks like internally. It's very narrow. You can see how small these corridors are. The point being, no prisoner ever went there because they're all locked in their cells more or less full time, exercising, coming in and out when they enter and leave the prison through the exercise yard. There's no need for wide open association spaces for them internally to the prison because they never come there. In fact, the doors, if you can see, compare the height of the people to these doors. The people are much taller than the doors are because the doors are not for use by people coming in and out. They're for putting food in and out and various and things like that. So, now, the 19th century then became a kind of golden age of prison building. The design, the basic radial design of the prison that was established in Philadelphia in that period, was re-transported to the old world, in this case to Scotland. This is Perth Prison, which was built around the same time as the Eastern Penitentiary, but for prisoners of war. So like Dartmoor in England, it was never intended as a civil prison, but came into use as one after the Napoleonic Wars ended. And that's the interior of Perth Prison today. What do you think of that image as compared to that one? Any thoughts about that?
It's got a lot less
height. Sorry?
The space doesn't seem nearly as high.
It's not as high. It's not as kind of cathedral-like in that extraordinary height.
Less colour.
Yeah. It's kind of become cleaner, brighter, shinier, more for people's use in some sense. But nevertheless, I would argue, fundamentally similar in its basic construction, just as you can see the basic shape of the prison is. So what did all these people think over this now fairly extended 200-year history that they were accomplishing by sending people to prison? Well, one of the interesting things about this, I think, is that the disputes about prison set in early on. So what the French observers, Alexis de Tocqueville and Gustave de Beaumont, thought when they were sent by the post-revolutionary French government to observe American society and American prisons, and reported back in the 1830s, was that when they went to Philadelphia and when they went to Auburn in New York, what they had seen was something revolutionary, new, hopeful, optimistic, and fundamentally different from the kinds of filth, degradation and insanitariness that they found in the prisons of Europe. A new kind of prison, one for which humanity need not blush, as they put it here. Conversely, on the other hand, Sidney Smith, writing in the Edinburgh Review in 1822, the year after the foundation of the Eastern Penitentiary, said, "The real and only test of a good prison system is the diminution of offences by the terror of punishment." In other words, that same principle of deterrence that Mr. Howard was mobilising in the 1990s. So, on the one hand, there's always been this kind of underlying sense that prisons must scare people straight. On the other, running like a thread through the modern history of imprisonment has been some kind of hope that they might be civilizable, improvable, and change people's behaviour in benign ways. But even though we're now in the mid 19th century with Charles Dickens, those high hopes of the early reformers were saying, this is a beautiful gate at the temple that leads to a happy life and a peaceful end to heaven. Dickens took a quite different view. He said, I believe that very few men are capable of estimating the immense amount of torture and agony that this dreadful punishment, he's talking about the Philadelphia system now, prolonged for years, inflicts upon the sufferers. I hold this slow and daily tampering with the mysteries of the brain to be immeasurably worse than any torture of the body. Those who have undergone this punishment must pass into society again, morally unhealthy and diseased. And indeed, there was some evidence that that was, for many, the case. So early histories of, or histories of the early prison, often refer to the fact that people went mad, screamed, shouted, yelled, tried everything they could to make some kind of human connection with, either with the guards or with other prisoners, and so on and so forth. Prisons are very important to Dickens, we might bear in mind. Why? Well, his father went to prison as a debtor. You see the ways in which they figure in his fiction, but I don't have time to go into it. But this kind of worry fed into official policy making at quite a deep level. So, at the same time as the public face of prisons always asserted that they were going to change people's behaviour for the better soon. So, Godfrey Lushington was the secretary to something called the Gladstone Committee, which in England and Wales, at the end of the 19th century, came up with a reformulation of the aims of imprisonment. But he himself said, I regard as unfavourable to reformation the state of a prisoner throughout his whole career, all these bad things he thinks it does. But of course, this is a mere idea. He says this in private correspondence. He can't say it as a public statement, because in public, the committee of which he was the secretary instead said this: prison discipline and treatment should be more effectually designed to maintain, stimulate or awaken the higher susceptibilities of prisoners, to develop their moral instincts, to train them in orderly industrial habits, and wherever possible, to turn them out of prisons better men and women, morally and physically, than when they came in. So the public conclusion of the committee, of which he was the secretary, was that this was the purpose of imprisonment, but his private correspondence said that he wasn't at all sure that this was even possible. And following the Gladstone Committee, this is the 1964 version, but it begins much earlier. In the English, this was Prison Rule 1 of the English prison rules. It was also included in the Prison Scotland Rules, Rule 5, that the purposes of the treatment and training of convicted prisoners shall be to establish in them the will to lead a good and useful life. So throughout the history of modern British imprisonment, that phrase crops up again and again. It's called the good and useful life formula. That's what prisons were supposed to be achieving, but it's entirely different from what Mr. Howard meant by what he said when he asserted in the 1990s that prison works. So we've undergone a kind of counter-revolution from the point at which, from the historic presumption that prisons were going to change behaviour for the better and enable people to lead good and useful lives, to ones in which the only thing left is incapacitation and deterrence. And we can see this statement, Alexander Paterson, when he made the statement, was chair of the Prisons Commission in England and Wales. In other words, he was what we would now call the chief executive of the prison service. And he said that people are sent to prisons as punishment, not for punishment. In other words, it was a conception of a kind of normalising idea of imprisonment, that the confinement itself was the penalty, and it was no longer necessary to kind of add complications or tribulations or additional requirements onto that. So this is the period of time in which the idea of imprisonment with hard labour, or in any other way something additional to the mere fact of confinement, drops out of the language. Prisons are the punishment in themselves in that modern view. So prisons are punishment, prisons are people improvement, prisons are incapacitators, and prisons are deterrers. And we need to decide, or help our political masters to decide, which of these principles, if any, we think hold, whether they're compatible with one another, which of them are morally defensible, which of them carry any evidential weight, and so on and so forth. But this is what the scripture... you can probably not read this. Can you read this? It's rather small. These are the aims of the Scottish Prison Service as they are now formulated. It's worth our while. I know we want to pause for a drink and so on in a moment, but these are the aims of the Scottish Prison Service. Now, remember what the aims of the prison have been in the past. To enable people to live a good and useful life, or even to provide the gate of the temple which leads them to a happy life and a peaceful end and so to heaven. Now what we say is, we will be recognised as a leader in offender management services for prisoners that help reduce reoffending and offer value for money for the taxpayer. And we will deliver offender management services, programmes and activities. We will deliver an estate fit for purpose in the 21st century. We will deliver our difficult work with professionalism and skill. We will work in partnership with other organisations. How does this strike you as a mission statement for the contemporary prison system? And what has changed over time, which leads us here rather than some of the places we've been, do you think? What are the implications of this statement as distinct from some of those earlier ones? They're thinking about helping, reducing, providing. They're certainly thinking about prisoners as humans at some level. Anything else?
I think they're like, taking into account all the other factors. One, when a prisoner goes out, and what kind of services
right.
can gauge while they're in there.
Right.
Just
right.
Smash rocks.
So they're saying there's a limited amount that we can do. Because we know where people come from. We know what environments they come from. We know what they're going back to. We know that these prisoners come from, overwhelmingly, from certain places, that they have radically disrupted educations very often. They have no qualifications. Many prisoners aren't even registered with a doctor. We can do so much. We can do a little bit. We can provide services. We can give secure custody and good order. That's it. It's a massive scaling down of the ambitions of the penological hopes and aspirations and ambitions of what the prison can do, at the same time as aspiring, I suppose, to do those things professionally and well. Is that it? Is that the best for which we can hope in the contemporary era? And if so, is it something that we see as being in any way inspirational or aspirational, or is it merely a realistic understanding that the prison is a particular kind of institution which can only do certain things and it will try to do those things as well as it can? So, if that's... And what it doesn't say is that prison works. It doesn't say that prison works in any kind of magical sense. It doesn't say that prison will deter. It does think, arguably, that prison might incapacitate. It holds people securely. But it's a limited, specific set of ambitions that people can try to translate into certain definite actions. It wouldn't be surprising to see a very similar statement of aims and actions attributed to a local authority, agency, or a company, or many other kinds of institution, it seems to me. So this is just in parenthesis because I think it's interesting. This is the kind of post-life of the Eastern State Penitentiary. It's now considered to be one of the 10 most haunted buildings in America. It's a tourist attraction. You can go around it and be shouted at and admitted by guards in old-time uniforms who will demean you and yell at you and kind of call you names. And then zombie inmates will jump out at you from dark places. The prison has a different... You can go and see a cell once occupied by Al Capone, which has been decorated to his own tastes and personal preferences. And you can, and it's like going on a ghost tour of old Edinburgh. Which is interesting, because it poses a certain kind of underlying set of questions about not only what we think prisons work to do, but also what role they play in our popular culture and our imagination, our film and TV and storytelling and so on and so forth. So, here's somewhere we are now. The official aim of the current Scottish Government, following the report of the MacLeish Commission a couple of years ago, is to reduce the prison population an average 5,000 from its current 8,000, and to have a higher involvement of community and educated people about community sentencing, finding alternatives to prison, making them more visible, reducing the use of prison to punishing serious crime and protecting the public, making community sentences more visible and more credible, so that we don't need to rely on imprisonment to the same extent. But, in actual fact, since the publication of that report, the relentless rise in the Scottish prison population has continued unchecked and without any noticeable difference. Where are we now? Here are some questions for sceptics that we might come back to after a drink. Does it matter? Does it matter to you how many prisons and prisoners there are? If it matters, why does it matter? What principle are we mobilising if we say we care, we're interested in the question? If you go back to that table that I showed you at the outset of all the different countries, do we have any way of saying which of those countries has got it right? And whether, you know, so why, if we think it matters how many people there are in prison, why does it matter? What would it mean to say there are too many prisoners or too few? And how would we work that out? After the revolution, when the sceptics have broken out of this underground enclave and the good society has been instituted, will there still be prisons? And if so, what will your prisons be like? What will you use them for? Does it make a difference? We've seen down through the history of imprisonment that all kinds of different grounds have been mobilised as to why we send people to prison, for their own good, for society's benefit, in order to incapacitate, in order to deter, in order to punish. Well, does it really make a difference which of those aims are the official policy, or is there something else going on that determines how many prisons there are and what they're like? And does it matter who runs the prisons? Does it matter to you whether the prisons are run only by directly employed agents of the state, or is it acceptable that some of them are run by commercial interests on a profit-making basis? So, here are some more naive questions, questions for sceptics. Are all prisons, after all of that, are all prisons actually basically alike? Are they all alike, really, when it comes right down to it? What does it mean to say that they are, and what does it mean to say that they're not? What are the implications of saying, yeah, basically? When I was doing writing a book a long time ago now, as a wee boy, I was trundling around a number of Her Majesty's prisons in England and Wales, talking to lots of people who'd been in prison a very long time and knew lots about it from a very personal point of view. And lots of them were really interested to talk to us, felt they had lots to tell us about prisons and really wanted to talk about them. And then we met this one guy who looked at us and said, I really can't be asked to talk to you because prison's prison. Meaning, actually, at the end of the day, whatever you do, whatever your research concludes, whatever policy is introduced that might or might not improve matters, at the end of the day, to him, all prisons were basically alike. And we've seen, haven't we, that they were instituted on a certain model that's proved massively influential down through their whole history, such that the contemporary shape of prisons, was established and radically influenced by things that took place as long ago as the 1820s. But what does it mean to suggest that prisons are not all alike? What would it mean to say, for example, here's a group of people rehearsing an opera in Shotts Prison in Scotland now, and here's some other people in a Brazilian prison looking like they're not putting on an opera. And that basically, you know, the prisons are not in that sense all alike. To be sent to prison in Sweden and in Sierra Leone are fundamentally different experiences from the point of view of your chances of survival intact, let alone from other outcomes. So here are the questions. Let's come back to them. Actually, you've got your own questions. Does it matter? What are too many? Will there be prisons in the good society? Does it make a difference what the stated aims of imprisonment are? Does it matter who runs the prisons? And are all prisons basically alike? We might even like to have a debate, if time permits. But I'm going to leave that to the audience to determine. And let's have a drink.